guys. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick. My name is Dick. Stand by. At this time, we start the TechNet, as we have for the last 34 or so years, 35 years it's going on. This will be TechNet number 1640. You'll also be hearing Space Report number 240 from Paul WS2N. Part of what we'll probably be discussing tonight is the flea market or ham convention that took place this weekend in Levittown. So you guys got some good goodies. We'll be hearing a little bit about that. But some sad news. Unfortunately, we won't be hearing from John. Another experiment we're running tonight is to find out, is anybody in ham radio not watching the Academy Awards? Are they willing to sign into the TechNet? We'll find that out. Last week, of the people who signed in, let me drop. Last week, of the people who signed in, Andy, Kilo, Delta 2, Mike, Tango, Papa, did not get a chance to get his question answered. We got heavy into television and went on for a long period of time, and John probably, and Andy probably had to leave, go to sleep or whatever. So if Andy signs in tonight, because we didn't get to him last week, he goes to number one on the list, if you know what I mean. Okay, so is there anybody out there not watching the Academy Awards? We're about to find that out. You're going to give us your call letters. You're going to give me your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. After 34 years, we don't need a long list of people signing in just to say they're listening. By now, after 34 years, we believe somebody is listening. So give me your call letters and name if you've got a question or a comment right now. K2RIW listening.
N2HUH, November 2, Hotel, Uniform Hotel.
N.
KB2BFY.
YY Joe, yes.
This is KD2 Queen Yankee Whiskey. Name here is Joe. And no, I'm not watching the TV awards.
Yep.
Okay, so far we've got Andy. Andy one, number one, Andy number two. HUH and ESY, Joe number one, RYY, Joe number two, QYW. There was another person trying to sign. Give me your call letters and name, sir. And press the mic, wait a second or two, and then give us your information. K2RIW listening.
And good evening, sir.
Okay, I heard good evening, Dick, and I heard nothing before that. Please repeat your message, sir. K2RIW.
B2GXM, Rich, yes.
I doubled, I guess. This is WS2N, Paul, with the Space Report.
Very fine, Paul. And Rich, Whiskey Bravo 2, is that Golf X-Ray November?
It's Golf X-Ray Mike, Rich. Nice.
DPZ with a quickie answer.
Okay, I thank you for that, Rich. Okay, the first person on the list was Andy in 2HUH. Go right ahead, Andy.
Okay, thank you, Richard, and good evening to all at one event. I've been to South America in the past for a visit, doing many things, including astronomy. But this time I would like to bring also amateur radio with me. And I wanted to set up a long wire antenna. And maybe someone or you can tell me approximately the length, height off the ground. You know, that would be sort of optimum, you know, not within reason. And what should I expect from operating in South America? And so on and so forth. But basically, 100-watt radio, low-wire antenna, some type of antenna tuner. What do you think? What should I shoot for? Because I'm not able to do this type of antenna installation here. So if I have a property that's the size of a football field, what kind of antenna should I put up for? One antenna for transmit and receive. N2, AQH.
As you know, Andy, there's no one answer for that. There's a large number of... As I was starting to say, there's a whole lot of answers for that one now, Andy. Stand by a minute. Okay. Looks like I'm back on. My favorite is an antenna that requires no ground plane and can be fed at one end. That's my favorite. An end-fed wire, one-half wavelength long. If the wire is one-half wavelength long, then it requires essentially no ground plane, no counterpoise. That's the good news. The bad news is you're feeding a 2,000 ohm impedance, and therefore it requires a step-up device, an LC network. But it would be a very simple LC network, and a single piece of wire can easily be shot up into a tree with a slingshot, bow and arrow, and whatever, with a string behind it. So as long as there's some kind of a nearby support that you have access to, that's one easy way to go. Half wavelength long on each one of the bands, set at one end. You'll need a slightly different impedance matching network for each band, because the network that steps up your impedance to 2,000 ohms on 80 meters is not going to be the same as a network, an LC network, that does it on 40 meters. It could be done with a transformer, a toroidal transformer, but that impedance ratio, 50 to 2,000 ohms, that's that's a 40 to 1. A 40 to 1 impedance ratio, square root of that is about 6. So a toroidal transformer with a 6 to 1 turns ratio could be made to operate on every one of those bands. See, the nice simplistic thing about feeding one end of a wire is that the end that comes near the ground is the wire that you feed. The antenna plus transmission line is all in one, spot. You don't have to worry about the feeding the center of a dipole and supporting all of the heavy transmission line going up to the center. So that's my particular suggestion. Half wavelength, end fed wire. And the fact that the wire is not parallel to the ground, don't worry about that. The fact that it's tilted gives you slant polarization, which means you can talk to the horizontal guys, the vertical guys, and put the wire at a slanted angle of 40. A 45-degree angle, so to speak, will have no null off the end. There'll be no null in the battery. You'll be able to talk in all directions. So that's one very simple piece of wire fed at one end. That's my suggestion. Guaranteed there's other people on the net who have other suggestions of simple antennas, dipole-like antennas. And the fact that you've got an antenna tuner really makes this work very easily. The antenna tuner is not going to handle the 40-to-1 ratio. That requires that either that's a 6-to-1 turns ratio toroidal transformer or a LC network for each one of the bands. But if you're willing to feed a dipole with a transmission line, they're very compact. And the G5RV dipole works on essentially all bands at once. And there are various people that will tell you that thing are ready to roll. Let's see, we have other people on the frequency who have a simple antenna that's portable, for Andy to set up in South America on a good sized piece of land. Give me your call letters right now. K2RIW, the TechNet.
Delta Papa Zulu has some very good suggestions.
Good evening, Dick. KTUBS Mobile. I have some antenna links that'll work for me.
Go right ahead, Rich. And by the way, Rich, tell us where you're located. K2UPS, K2RIW.
I'm still in Ohio at this point. We got out of Louisville a little bit late. But the simplest, like you said, would be an end head. And random wire is sort of a misnomer. There are lengths that you want to avoid, especially if you're trying to get a wire to work on multiple bands. I have had very good success using a 9-to-1 toroidal matching transformer and unbalanced to unbalanced. There's plenty of plans for those online. For multi-band operations would be 29 feet, 35 feet, 41 feet, 58 feet. As a matter of fact, for this past winter field day, the end of January, I used a 58-foot N-fed wire set up like an inverted L. It went vertically 30 feet and then horizontally at the other 28. And I only had 4 16-foot counterpoises at the ground. It was fed at ground level. And I made 75 160-meter contacts, CW contacts on that antenna. Plus, it loaded up on all the other bands, 80 to 10. So you can't get much simpler than that back to net.
Boy, that sounds like a beauty. And that's some real good experience you've had with that one. So you like the length of 29, 35, 41, but your favorite was 58 feet. So the 58 feet, which was vertical, 30 feet, and bent over 28 feet, you fed that on every band from 10 meters down to 160 meters with an antenna tuner and a 9-to-1 transformer, 9-to-1 impedance ratio transformer. Let's see, 9 times 50 would be about 500. That's close enough. You probably, my guess is, Your impedance of the antenna probably was within 3-to-1 or 4-to-1, and therefore the antenna tuner could easily handle it. And if I know you, you probably ran this with a KX3. You may have even run this thing with a QRP. Is that true, Rich? K2UPS, K2LIW.
I have used a QRP, but this time was not. It was with a Kenwood 480 running 100 watts, and we had both an LBG tuner and the tuner that was in the Kenwood, and they both were able to load that antenna up on all those bands. So, I mean, I would never have thought that a 58-foot wire would load up, much less get out very well on, particularly on 160 meters. But it did. Now, of course, it helped having a contest that weekend, a 160-meter contest. But still, I didn't have to yell over and over and over again to get them to hear me. This was on CW, and one shot, they came right back, and I just banged them out, 75 in a row. So, N-fed wires can be real nice for portable operations. And you can just toss it into a tree, let it hang out a window. Lots of different possibilities.
Boy, that's a very nice experience. As a man who's done it, how did you select the length 58 feet as well as other lengths? Was there an article telling you about experiments that have done along these lines, or did you use the set of curves that show you the impedance versus length? All of a sudden, I can't think of the names of the two guys that wrote these set of curves that are on the websites that I've been telling you guys about. AmateurRadio.TangoVictor, and also LimeOxTechNet.com. You'll find the Brown and Woodward. Mr. Brown and Mr. Woodward, you tell him the diameter of the wire, the length of the wire, the frequency you're on. They'll tell you the exact impedance of the resistive component and the reactive component of impedance. And that's not just somebody's crazy formula. That's a real measurement. So where did that magic 58-foot in your case come from, Rich? Somebody must have had a darn good article, but you've done a lot of experimenting. KTUPS, and all.
Rich, before we continue with that question, Dick.
Okay. Go ahead, Andy.
I'd like to thank Richard UPS for joining us. All right. I mean, we can continue with the length of wire, but I'm very, very familiar with how to choose the length of wire. That's not my question, and I'm not getting any closer to making a decision here. If I'm already using 40 to 50-foot lengths of wire at my house, I don't know if I want to do that in South America when I can use 500 feet of wire or 300 feet of wire.
And possibly somewhere reasonably between 20 and 40 feet up in the air, I'm sure I can manage with the help I'll be having. So I can do 40 feet or 50 feet in the air, possibly. What I'm getting at here is I want to do something different to optimize 160 meters, I guess, to somewhere up to 40, 20 meters. And I'm used to using 50 feet of wire and an external automatic antenna to it. What I want to do there is, let me let it drop so we get the nature of my question. Is I don't want to use a non-resonant or resonant piece of wire that's 50 feet long. Either one. I don't want to do that. I want to use either an external remote antenna tuner for 100 watts up 40 feet, or I'll bring the wire down to my manual tuner, even if it's got to be a roller inductor style, next to the radio, and do it that way with the random wire coming down to the tuner. I need to make a decision on what I want to do here. I can't bring everything. So I want to put up a 300, 200, 400, 500 feet of wire and do what I can't do here. That's what I'm looking to do. I want to explore an experiment with wire, one antenna, all bands, and whatever tuner I need. That's kind of what I had in mind. If you wish to continue with the length of wire theory for Mitch, go right ahead. I just don't want to take up time that I personally don't need, because I understand resonant and non-resonant length antenna lengths.
ETC with a comment.
Andy, you're using good common sense, and you're falling into a trap. Good common sense would lead you to believe where you previously used 50 feet of wire, and if now you use 100, 150, 200, 300, 400 feet of wire, it's going to work better. Good common sense. Greater gain on transmit, bigger effective capture area on reception. Almost absolutely not true. You're falling into a trap on this one. I had two reasons for asking Rich for the information about the length of the wire. Lots of other people are listening, and they want to put up simple portable antennas, not only Andy. But once you electronically or mechanically, in other words, you choose a wire of the right length so that it is resonant on your band with your method of feeding it, or even if it's the wrong length and you electronically resonate it with loading coils, the top hat capacitor, zigzags, helical winding, and a very broadband antenna tuner. Let me drop. Once you resonate the antenna, it will radiate. It'll radiate well. And by the law of reciprocity, if it radiates well on transmission, it'll receive well. You're thinking that 300 and 500 feet of wire is going to give you a better antenna. The answer is almost no. It's going to give you an antenna with a whole bunch of fingers in space and a whole bunch of notches in between those fingers. It's a more complicated pattern when the antenna is multiple wavelengths long. In general, it does not have more gain. The only way you get more gain is to do something like a Yagi-like structure, if you know what I mean. Something with a driven element, a director, and a reflector. So the fact that you're going to put a longer piece of wire is not necessarily better. It's just going to fill up your briefcase that you're going out there with, and it's going to give a little bit more difficulty of the installation. That's an opinion. It's a strongly felt opinion by me. Let me see if a Rich, who's actually done it, has, in all of his research and all of his real installations, if he's found something similar. So my main question to you, Rich, do you believe Andy would pick up any advantage by putting up 500 feet of wire instead of 58 feet of wire? K2UPS in Ohio, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KPPS Mobile. He might see a bit of improvement if he's going to be working 160 meters, but other than that, I don't think it's really going to help. The information that I found on the wire length can be found on the web. One of the sites was hamuniverse.com. Hamuniverse.com. They had a chart there that lists all the different bands. You choose which bands you want to work, and then go down this, it's kind of like a bar chart, in a colored band, and you have to choose an area that's not colored in other words, it's white. So if you're looking for one white to do multiple bands, you really don't want it resident on any one band, because that's what can cause you issues when you want to use it on multiple bands. But there are several different websites, too. If you just Google random wire lengths or NFED wire antennas, you'll find multiple hits for sites that can give you information. But as far as running it out 400 feet, 500 feet, if you're interested in talking on 20, 40 meters, I don't really think that's going to help much. If anything, if the long wire is multiple wavelengths long, it tends to exhibit a little bit of directivity in the direction of the wire. But if you can just use, like, say, a 58-foot, like I had mentioned before, and get it vertically, you'll get a nice omnidirectional pattern. If you're going to put that wire horizontal and it's close to the ground, unless it's very high up, you're not going to get, distance. I don't know how far he's trying to get from South America back up here, but he might be better running the wire vertically instead of horizontally, unless he can get it up very high.
Very fine, Rich. You're somewhat supporting what I feel is true, but I'm not an HF person, so I got to be careful here. Andy, you might have some additional questions on what you just heard. I know darn well that every bit of altitude you can get for that wire is going to be helpful. And according to Rich, if you can make that wire non-resonant, but to resonate it electronically by way of the ballon and a broad antenna tuner, you're going to be very well off in multiple bands with one piece of wire. But a vertically polarized piece of wire, as high up as you can get it, is my opinion. And you're allowed to ask more questions on this, Andy. And it's a darn good question, so don't worry about taking up time. You're in the subject that a lot of people want to know about. N2HUH, H-U-R-I-W. You got it, Andy.
Okay, I'll say the two Richards, thank you for bringing me back down to earth. I was just mentally conditioned by at least a dozen amateurs on 160 meters while I'm QSOing or making contacts. That yes, I'm doing very well with my 50 feet of my station or 50 feet of wire, but however, I need to put up at least a quarter wavelength on 160 meters, 80 meters, you know, that type of thing. So I say, well, here's my big opportunity. And not that you're bursting my bubble, but yes, all right, so now I'm happy for my home station. But I would still like to try, yes, a 53-foot long vertical and also put up a, I don't know, 100, whatever resonant or non-resonant. Actually, I prefer non-resonant than wire that's at least a quarter wavelength on 160 meters. I think I'll do daytime amateur radio and some evening 160-meter
repeater. Time out. Repeater. Time out. Cancel.
I ask a query. Mike Papa Whiskey, we heard you very well. You had good audio and good RF. He wanted a signal report, so he got his signal report, but there's a net in progress. The person with the query, I think that was Andy number two, ESY, is that true? Go ahead.
AC2IS with a query.
Okay. AC2IS, K2RIW. Go ahead, Bill.
Hey, Dick. Sort of overhearing a conversation recently where people were talking about antenna separation. And one of the things that was said was that if you have two antennas on the same band, and if you're giving them horizontal separation, they should be at least a quarter wave apart. I'm thinking that's way too short of a distance, and at that distance, I forget what you call that, a near wave. Essentially, the other antenna at that distance would sort of act like part of the other antenna, sort of like a director element. Is that correct, AC2IS?
Hey, you're into an entirely different subject, Bill. When you put two pieces of wire close together, eighth wave, quarter wave, half wave apart, and they're various lengths, you're now getting a reflector operation, director operation, Yagi operation, and so there's a whole lot of other things going on here. But getting back to what Andy's original question was, Andy, because the wire itself is not an expensive product, and you really want to do an experiment with 500 feet of wire, I would bring to South America a 500-foot roll of wire and a 58-foot roll of wire and any other rolls if you want to, and actually run the experiment. My prediction is that once you resonate whatever wire length you've got on whatever band you've got with the highest altitude you can muster, the resonance is the magic. You've heard my example a couple of times. Let me drop it. A person takes a full half-wave dipole on 80 meters, 132 feet long, 60 feet in the air, we'll say. 132 foot long piece of wire, true half wavelength on 80 meters. And because he doesn't have a backyard that's big enough, he only has 32 feet of wire, not 132 feet of wire. He's down to one quarter of the length. He's going to have a huge high reactive impedance, a very capacitive antenna. Assuming he's got the right kind of a tuner on the far end of the transmission line, so he's properly feeding it and resonating it, that quarter length half, the half-wave dipole has been brought down to a quarter wavelength, but electronically resonated, never loses more than half a dB of gain compared to the full-length dipole. So as long as you're resonating it with items that don't have any loss to them. This is opposite of common sense, but this has come from an extremely good source, the Bible on the subject, the book called Antennas by Mr. Krauss, McGraw-Hill, 1950, John Krauss of Ohio University. Let me drop it. His article on the infinitesimal dipole, as long as it's resonated, it comes up to the full effective capture area. That's the magic of resonance. You make the antenna too small and you resonate it, it's going to be high in Q. It's going to be very narrow band. You QSY 10KC and you got to retune. That's a disadvantage. But once it's resonated, it gives you full performance. Making the wire a zillion wavelengths long gives you an antenna pattern that tends to be end fire. In other words, all the lobes you're creating, eventually all those lobes start lying parallel to the wire. And so you'll be squirting a signal off the two ends, so to speak, if you make the wire very long, multiple wavelengths. But each of those lobes do not have a hell of a lot more gain. You would think you're going to get a lot more area and a lot more gain because you got a lot more wire. Good common sense. You talk to the guys in 20 meters, 80% of them will tell you that that's the truth. I'm telling you it's not, and to some degree, Rich is telling you it's not. So bring various lengths of wire and various ways of impedance matching them, and do the experiment, Andy, and come back and tell us what you find. In 2HUH, K2RIW in the tech test.
Okay, Richard, very good. Okay, now I'm back. You know, 5 cups of coffee today, getting up early with 3 hours of sleep and going to the ham fest and not feeling well enough to go to the salt mine. You'll have to excuse my demeanor a little bit there. I'm a little, in order to stay awake, I got to be excited. But but anyway, what I still don't know is, do I bring the rolls of wire for experiment? What should I bring? My ICOM AH2 automatic external antenna tuner so I can feed the wire at the, so to speak, at the base of, or the feed point of the wire, rather? Or do I bring my El Cheapo, whatever, store-bought or homemade, $100 or less antenna tuner, or do I bring my home-brewed roller inductor antenna tuner that will handle about 200 watts, even though I don't need that much, and go to town with that? I'm still not sure which style of antenna tuner I should bring, and I can't bring them all. So what do you think? And to which ways? And do I need a 9-to-1 balance if I'm bringing those type of tuners with me? Go ahead.
Okay, from my point of view, the expert on packing well, packing efficiently, going portable every third day of his life of doing field day ham radio, is Rich, K2UPS. He's going to answer those questions for you. K2UPS, take your time and give him all the pros and cons of all of those methods of feeding. You got it, Rich, in Ohio. K2UPS, K2RIW.
KCUPS Mobile. Well, I really can't help too much with what tuner to bring. I might say the automatic one just because it would be easier, but the manual one may have more range in it, particularly if he doesn't want to use any sort of matching transformer at the base of the wire. I don't really have any experience myself with large antenna tuners. Mostly I just use the one that's built into my QRP rig. Now that'll handle up to 20 to 1, which is pretty wide for an automatic antenna tuner. But I know he's bringing more power, so I'm not familiar with the other tuners that he mentioned.
Okay, but handle one other factor here. He could use a transmission line. It might be open wire line, it might be coax, and he feeds the center of the antenna, and now lives with the fact that a remote antenna tuner doesn't give you as much loss of the coax when you're in a non-resonant and forcing it to resonate in the shack, as opposed to end feeding. I have the impression that a lot of your antenna remote operations were end feeding a piece of wire where there is essentially no transmission line, or you can say because the wire that the antenna is this L shape, the first 30 feet going up is the transmission line and simultaneous vertical resonator. So when it comes to keeping it simple, keeping it portable, I think there's a lot to be said about end feeding. You need very little counterpoise, ground plane radials and whatever. You need no transmission line, a great big roll of coax. If he's going to send 500 feet of wire out there, and he's going to feed the middle of it with coax, he's going to have 150 feet of coax, which that in itself is a very bulky material to transport, as opposed to 500 feet of wire, which is 10 times more compact, and feeding one end of it. So my impression, Rich, is that feeding the end of the wire with the right kind of impedance matching, maybe a 9-to-1 balun, and the antenna tuner, a simple antenna tuner, so to speak, is one way to keep it simple but still be high in performance, and that's what I think you have done a lot of. You might have an opinion on this one, Rich. K2UPS in Ohio, K2RIW in the TechNet.
That's correct, Vic. Most of the time I'm running an end-fed wire, usually 29, 30 feet long to the top of the pole. I do not run separate counterpoise wires on it. I have tried single and multiple wires and didn't see any difference that would require me to do that on a regular basis. It wasn't a noticeable difference. So just to save setup time and to have more operating time, I choose not to run the counterpoise wires. Any shield on the coax, because I'm running usually 25 feet of coax, the shield acts as the counterpoise. Now, sometimes I do get a little bit of RF back into the radio, depending on where I'm set up, bent, and where the coax, how the coax is run to the radio, and then I have a one-to-one choke that I can put in to help alleviate that, but I usually don't put that in unless I find I'm having an issue.
Eric recognized, I'm going to ask for Rich to give us a little bit more of a clarification here. When you're putting in the RF choke, because you've got a little bit of RF in the shack, it sounds to me like you've got the first 20 feet of coax from the rig in your portable vehicle going out to the base of this end-fed piece of wire. So the small piece of coax that you're putting an RF choke in it, but then the real transmission line is the wire itself. K2UPS, K2RIW.
Well, when I'm set up, say I have the radio on the table, then I run 25 feet of coax out, put a stake in the ground, that's where I put the mast to support the antenna. So there's 25 feet of coax from the radio to the 9-to-1 at the base of the antenna. The 1-to-1 I can attach directly at the radio if it's needed, and then I still have 25 feet of coax, and it's still being used as the counterpoise. But any RF that's coming back down the shield of the coax now gets blocked and not into the radio and causes it to do some strange things.
Question. Well done, very good. We gotta hear from Eric, but I know Andy asked the original question, so you're allowed to ask for clarifications on what you've heard so far, Andy. N2HUH, K2RIW, you got it, Andy.
This is DTZ with a comment.
Thank you very much, Dick. Thank you, Richard. And good to hear you again. Good to talk to you. And hello, Eric. What I wanted to ask Rich UPS was is that the common mode RF choke as opposed to the 10-coil choke? That's the, it looks like a Balun, I believe, and it's that's the common mode choke that he's referring to, or is there another type that I'm not aware of? Go ahead, Richard, UPS.
Yeah, I think he's talking about a one-to-one transformer, sort of like an isolation transformer. Is that somewhat true, Rich? K2UPS, K2RAW?
That is correct. It is a matching a one-to-one transformer with a toroid in it. They're easy to make, or you can look online at balundesigns.com. Has some excellent ones for a decent price. I have a bunch of their products. But you can also use the, you know, the old, what, 10 turns on a soda bottle type of deal. Either one of those will work fairly well for snaring some of that stray RF that's on the outside of the coax.
CPZ with a comment.
And one other clarification, Rich. In the case of your 9-to-1 Balun, does that also have a Baluning function to it? In other words, the point, not only is it a 9-to-1 impedance step up, but is there a true primary and secondary so that it gives you isolation transformer-like action? Is that true of your particular 9-to-1 Balun, Rich? K2UPS, K2RAW?
KTBS, I'm sorry, just get back into the truck. I don't think the 9-to-1 does any isolation. That's why sometimes I do get the coax radiating, but the it's a toroid inside a little case.
It sounds like your 9-to-1 really is the kind that's got a tap on it, as opposed to a completely primary and secondary. I know Eric wants to give us more information on this. KE2EJ, K2LAW, go ahead, Eric.
K2LAW, K2EJ. I just gotta just mention, when I go out and I do stuff out in the field, I tend to bring something called an artificial ground with me to deal with the RF problem when I'm using a, you know, I'm doing an NFET thing, and I tend to use the coax as a bit of a counterpoise, but the artificial ground gets rid of the RF on the outside of the coax after the Balun, so that's just my little 2 cents worth. K2RAW, K2J.
What's an artificial ground, Eric?
That's exactly what I'm going to ask. Give us some words on the artificial ground. Homebrew, commercial, how many dollars, how big, because he's got to transport it. K2EJ, K2LAW.
No, mine's homebrew, but you can buy them from MFJ, you can buy it, I think even Palomar makes them. Essentially what you wind up doing is making the ground path resonant, and you wind up with a better counterpoise, and you don't wind up having the RF coming back at the radio.
Your particular artificial ground, is it an article that you found in QST, or did you homebrew it out of your own engineering background? Back to you, Eric.
No, I would love to say that I designed it, but there's been a number of articles. I think that I've found something together. It's pretty simple.
N2 moon bounce. I know that you were asking some questions on this one, Barry. N2MB, K2LAW.
I just wanted to know how he made the artificial ground. That's all. That was a little bit of a surprise to me. I've seen articles, and I may even have one here. I don't know. I got something made by MFJ, but I don't know.
K6GTZ with a comment about tennis.
Eric, if I drive over to your house and I lay my eyes on your artificial ground, tell me what I'm going to see. How big? How expensive? Tell me what it looks like. You got it, Eric.
Oh, basically, it's just a bunch of coils. Actually, three coils and a couple of pads with a variable fan. You can think of it as an antenna tuner for the shield, so to speak. They're not expensive. I think the MFJ is something like $60 or $70. I think the Palomar is a little more expensive, but it isn't that bad.
Yeah, Roger. I think I have one by MFJ. It looks like a little antenna tuner.
Where did you buy it? How many dollars was it, Barry?
I actually did not buy it. I don't even know how I got it. I'm going to take it out of the closet. I have it in the closet, so I'm going to take it out and I'll explain it to you.
Okay, Keith. Thank you, all these guys. So I hope you've got a couple of weeks before you actually go to South America, Andy, where you get a chance to gather these pieces of material and do a trial run of all the hardware, make sure it works well in the nearest schoolyard, so to speak. So back to you for any further fill, and you're allowed to bring this question up again next week and the week after that before you go to South America. And what you call it is going to be down there. N2HUH, K2IW, the TechNet.
This is GPZ with the comment. That... Well, that's all. This is all a work in progress. I'm definitely going. I may even change my plans and go later. But the point is I have to iron out all these. Do anything and do it right. You have to do it right, especially. Appropriately takes time, and you have to do it in order. But I know one thing is that if I'm bringing equipment, it's going to look like it's in two or three pieces. So it's going to look used. It's going to look old. That's one thing I'm going to do. I don't know if I need paperwork or not on it. I'm looking into that too. But the fact that it's going to be old, repaired, looking like it was broken, and so on and so forth, will help on the checking, because if anything happens, c'est la vie. And homebrew stuff, you can tell it's not manufactured, so that's why I'm tending to go that direction, so there's no problem, and so on and so forth. And I have to contact somebody at the ARRL, because I certainly don't know what to do about the call sign or paperwork for customs in South America, so I have to iron all this out. I'm still not sure what antenna tuner I'm going to bring, though, at this point. After all this advice and discussion, I still have decisions to make.
Yeah, when you do your dry run, you're going to find out one of them is better than the other. KE2EJ, K2RIW, go ahead, Eric.
Andy, call hell.
Now, there's something called CLEP, C-L-E-P, I'm not sure if I'm spelling it right, but it's basically an international agreement where you can go to certain countries that are CLEP countries and you can use your own call sign. You don't have to register with them. Although when I went to Japan, I took the 817 with me and a bunch of stuff, and I actually have a Japanese call. That's one of the countries that we don't have that type of agreement with.
Good information, Eric. And Andy, your idea of bringing homebrew-looking, used-looking, slightly dirty-looking, non-commercial-looking equipment, there's a lot of smarts in doing that. First of all, nobody's going to want to steal it, but the customs people, in many cases, they're scared to death to find out that you're going to be bringing expensive pieces of electronics into the country and selling it. And so the worst that will happen is I guess you have to register your pieces of equipment with you, so they're going to count the boxes going in and count the boxes coming back out to make sure you're running an electronic sale. That's what I think is one of the things that customs is concerned about. I wonder, have I got that right, you guys? K2RIW, anybody wants to come in on that?
Mint N1YDY.
K2EJ. Okay, YDY and EJ in that order. And go ahead, N1YDY.
It's been a long time, but I took a fancy telescope into Mexico, and what I was required to do at the land border was to have the serial number of the telescope attached to the customs card that was in my passport. And when I went to leave Mexico, I had to turn that card in and check the serial number of the telescope on the way out against the serial number that they had recorded on the way in. And it was really rather painless, even though it was, as you say, when I was on my way in, there was a little bit of hesitation because they were were afraid I would be trying to sell it. But when they realized that I was there to see a solar eclipse, they were, a lot less fearful when they realized there was a purpose and I had a definite time to see.
Hank, you are a pilot, therefore you get a chance to go to many crazy countries during solar eclipses or whatever. So my guess is you've had quite a bit of experience of bringing expensive-looking things into a country and bringing them back out, as long as they're properly registered and serial numbered. You've never had to pay a tariff or whatever. Is that roughly true, Hank?
That's exactly my experience.
Well done. Eric said some further. Eric, you've done a lot of international travel. Like, you've gone to Hawaii a few times, and I guarantee you brought some exotic pieces of equipment to Hawaii. KE2EJ, K2RAW.
K2RAW, KE2EJ. Well, the first time I went to Hawaii, which was like 20 years ago, I brought my 757 with me. 767. And some antennas and mag mounts and stuff like that, but we were there for almost a month, so we took that with us. But normally I'll take like the 817. It's CEPT. And the CEPT is really the participating countries is really in Europe, not South America. There's a whole list. If you look it up, CEPT, you can get it from the AWOL website. And they give you what is recommended to take with you. One of the things I will recommend to anyone who's going out of the country and they're bringing their gear, before you go out of the country, you go to the customs agent at the airport. If you're at the airport, you can do that, the other thing. And you fill out I forget what the name of the form is, but it essentially has the model numbers and serial numbers of the gear that you're taking so that when you come back, they don't try to charge you a tax that you bought it somewhere else. That's kind of important. So do that well ahead of time before you actually leave the country. K2RAW, K2EJ.
Todd, good information. And I thank you, Eric. Okay. Hopefully you'll have a couple more weeks to iron out these details and to do a dry run on all of this equipment. And the way the equipment behaves in your hand with your particular setup method is what you really care about. And you're blazing a little bit of a trail here, Andy. Not many of us have done exactly what you're trying to do. Next person on our list was Andy number 2, KD2 Echo Sierra Yankee. And when you checked in, your audio was quite low on that particular rig, Andy. So shout into the mic a little bit. KD2ASY, K2RAW in the tech net.
K2RAW, KD2ESY, Andy here. Thank you, Dick. I appreciate it. As far as your question about the Grammys or whatever is running tonight, because when you're not watching, I don't do brain damage. Question, which an idea came up at the Ares meeting last week. Mounting multiple antennas at different vertical heights at certain horizontal distances. My question is, when a radiation pattern is emitted, what is the vertical height of the lobe, and won't these lobes interfere with one another from the different antennas if you're running multiple frequencies at the same time? I was concerned about interference. I understand that the antennas are set a certain vertical distance apart and horizontal. That might not be a problem. I don't know. I have my antenna book. Sorry, my rig has an automatic timeout. Basically, the question is vertical and horizontal distance of and multiple antennas, and do these lobes interfere with one another?
There's some yeses and nos. As the man who runs the set of articles, the doctor is in. His usual way of answering that kind of question is, yes, it depends. Okay. In the case of horizontal polarization, dipole-like antennas, horizontally polarized, and if there's some number of feet above the ground, to that horizontally polarized signal,
that ground is almost a perfect short circuit. Even though it's made out of dirt and lawn and loam and sand and whatever, it is almost a short circuit. A horizontal wave hitting a short circuit conducting object like Earth goes into a phase reversal. So in other words, if you were drawing a side view diagram of your whole antenna setup, horizontally polarized antenna, you've got a real antenna, we'll say 30 feet above the ground. You have a mirror image antenna 30 feet below the ground. That's what the ground bounce does for you. And the one below the ground is 180 degrees out of phase. Because the one below the ground is out of phase from the one above the ground, by definition, with horizontal polarization, you tend to have a deep null on the horizon. That signal going to the horizon sees an equal amount of power of the in-phase signal above the ground and the out-of-phase signal below the ground, so to speak, the mirror image. And where that vertical lobe falls, where your first vertical peak occurs, is a function of how many feet above the ground. Some angle above the ground, like a 30-degree angle above the ground, out in front of that dipole. Let me drop. The signal coming from the mirror image below the ground has a longer path to go through than the signal from the direct antenna above the ground. Therefore, the two signals starting out 100 degrees out of phase come back in phase. That's what makes that first vertical lobe. That's why the elevation pattern is almost 99% a function of how far the antenna is above the ground when it's horizontally polarized. Now, with vertical polarization, a vertically polarized antenna sends out a signal that bounces off the ground with almost the same characteristics. The craziness of vertical polarization is it does not experience 180 degrees of phase shift at a grazing angle. So therefore, a vertically polarized antenna tends to not give you a null on the horizon. You now get another crazy effect. Depending on the height above the ground, some number of degrees above the horizon is going to be the first null in the vertical pattern, and then you're going to come back to another peak, if you know what I mean. So as you can see, what ground reflection does, if you look at it as mirror image, side view, and you know you get this 180 degree phase shift with horizontal polarization and essentially no phase shift with vertical, that's your first step of getting one great big step out of understanding how these crazy antennas work at various altitudes. I'll see how much of that makes sense so far before we proceed, Andy. K2ESY, you could even shout a little louder into that mic, K2IW in the TechNet.
Okay, I do understand some of this. Apologize for my ignorance. If you have multiple vertical antennas next to one another, do they interfere with one another? And how high are these horizontal lobes?
In general, antennas that are being used on different frequencies, like different bands, 80 meters, 40 meters, 20 meters, antennas on different bands, in general, with rare exception, do not see each other. When you're transmitting a signal into that 80-meter antenna, and there's a 40-meter antenna 10 feet away from it, parallel to it, that 40-meter antenna is thoroughly transparent to the 80-meter signal. They do not see each other. Now, if you are stacking vertical antennas and you're stacking them in a collinear manner, in other words, they're all aligned one line, so to speak, if they're all being fed in phase, you're now building a vertical phased array antenna setup. You get extra gain out of that. You get more narrow pattern on the horizon. You're developing a pancake pattern. A station master antenna has got about five individual half-wave dipoles inside of that radome, all vertically stacked, and if you can see that pattern in three-dimensional space, it's a pancake on the horizon with very little signal above or below the horizon. So vertical stacking, multiple antennas, the way the signals all add up gives you that crazy pancake pattern. There's a lot more to it, but let's see how much this makes sense so far. KD2ESY, K2RIW, go ahead, Andy.
WB2HWW, with a comment, please.
Go ahead, comment.
You've got it, Howie.
Hello, everybody. I don't think he's asking about phasing. What he's trying to ask you, let's say, I'm kind of, you know, when you have a 6 meter or a 2 meter beam on the same rotor, how far apart do they have to be and do they affect each other? They're just going to be a few feet apart. As long as they're not, you know, a certain odd harmonic, you know, they won't interfere with each other. He's asking you a question, trying to put multiple antennas on one support structure, and he wants to know what you do. The only rule I have is you always put the highest frequency antenna at the top of your pole, and your lower frequency antennas go below. Like if you've got a 2 meter beam and a 6 meter beam, you put the 2 meter beam on top, the 6 on the bottom, and if you got 432, that goes above the 2. Back to you, Dick.
What Howie just described is the usual Christmas tree arrangement. A few feet of separation between the antennas. The number of feet is primarily defined by the amount of nearby capacitive loading of one antenna adding capacitance to the tips of the elements of the other antenna. If all the antennas being stacked on the same mast are on different bands, you can get away with murder with very close spacing, and they do not see each other. When you're on band A, the band Bravo antenna is thoroughly transparent to it 98% of the time, with a couple of exceptions. However, if you're vertically stacking antennas like that station master I just described, where they're all on the same band, same frequency, now there are very specific spacings that work well, and you want to make sure that the capture area of each antenna doesn't overlap. But the capture antenna of a 40-meter antenna, when you're radiating from a nearby 80-meter antenna, the capture area on 40-meter antenna of 80 meters is nearly zero. It's not resonant on that frequency. So I wonder if this makes a little more sense, Andy. And you can shout on that mic a little bit louder. KD2ESY, K2LIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW, KD2ESY. It does help understand. I'm actually wondering how high these lobes are, the vertical height of these lobes. I guess it doesn't really matter when you say that one frequency is invisible to another. My understanding from my limited physics training is that what frequencies, waves, do actually add and subtract to one another to a degree, maybe an infinitesimal degree, but they do add and subtract, hence we get some interference. Say you pick a typical 2 meter vertical, and you have another 2 meter vertical, maybe different frequency, X distance away, stacked vertically. How high do these lobes actually reach? Do they reach 2 feet in the air? Do they reach 200 feet in the air?
Okay, in your example, you've got a pair of 2 meter vertically polarized antennas on the same mounting structure going to two separate radios. In other words, you're not intentionally feeding the two antennas at once. You're feeding one while the other is sitting there passive. Because they're on the exact same band, you're going to get a fair amount of coupling. In other words, while you're transmitting antenna A and antenna B is 10 feet away, you're going to get a pretty strong signal into antenna B, into that other 2 meter radio. And it may give you some intermodulation distortion on the radio reception. If you try to receive frequency B in 2 meters on antenna B while transmitting on antenna A frequency, both on 2 meters, simultaneous transmission and reception, if that's what you're trying to do, that's a little bit difficult. It may require some extra techniques, but you're talking about lobes. You're assuming the lobes of the antenna pattern that you see when you see these three-dimensional antenna patterns in a book. Let me drop.
Question.
You've used good common sense, Andy, and you've assumed that the lobes out of the first antenna intercept the second antenna. Those lobes are an antenna pattern in the far field only. When you're 30 feet away from the antenna and you're measuring the pattern, those lobes exist. when you're up close to the antenna, when you're 10 feet away, that antenna pattern does not exist. There's an entirely different phenomenon when it comes to near-field coupling coefficient between antennas. And if there are two vertically stacked antennas, both collinear on the same mast, that happens to be the arrangement where there's very little coupling. So you're into a relatively difficult area to understand, but don't worry about the lobes of the first antenna hitting the second antenna. Those lobes only exist